Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 26 of the Theatrical Mustang Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Woodzik. This episode is with actor and writer and director and producer and basically just everything, Anish Sheth. And she's super awesome. It's one of those things, you know, where you have friends who know really cool people, and so you feel that you know them before you meet them, and then you meet them, and not only are they as cool as you thought they would be, they are even cooler. So that was the experience I had. We talk about her new original series called Crave. You can watch the first episode, the pilot, online at craveoriginalseries.com. That link is going to be in the episode description. This episode is sponsored by KLMXYZ Creative Communications. I highly recommend that you use Catherine Lynn Morgan for all of your graphic design and marketing needs. KLMXYZ.com is the website. I've used her to revamp my acting resume so it's formatted and sticks out, you know, stands out in a crowd. I've also used her for the poster design for my latest show, which I'm directing, Martin McDonagh's The Pillow Man, which is opening at Outcast Productions on July 10th. Really great cast. I have Max Koltakonikos, Jimmy Scullin, Ned Farley, Aaron Simpson. You're not going to want to miss this one. I mean, it's Martin McDonagh, right? Little black box theater on Whidbey Island. And hey, Seattle, Whidbey Island is not that far away. If you want more information about this show, which of course you do because you're going to want to come and see it, you can visit outcastproductions.net. This episode is also sponsored by Hedgebrook. Hedgebrook is a literary nonprofit, and they're all about supporting women authoring change. Yes, women writers. Woot! And the application for their Writers in Residence program is now available online. You have until July 28th to fill it out. And if you fill it out, you might get a fully funded residency of 2 to 6 weeks in a cottage of your own on Whidbey Island. It's definitely worth your time. Find out more information at hedgebrook.org and tell your friends about it who might not know about this really cool thing in our own backyard. So without further ado, please enjoy episode 26 with Anish Sheth. So I am absolutely thrilled to welcome Anish Sheth to the podcast. Welcome! I feel like it's taken ages for us to be in the same room.
Yes, it has taken a very long time.
I'm so excited.
But I am so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So I first saw you perform in Village Theater's production of Around the World in 80 Days, and we were talking a little bit before we started recording. That book has such a special place in my heart because when I moved away from my dad for the first time, I had this illustrated copy and I just would pore over it. And the idea of you could travel wherever in the world and, you know, you're still connected to the people that you love.
Oh,
can you talk about how you got involved with that project and what that was like?
Yes. So I got involved with that project because I had just moved here about a year and a half ago and I had seen Les Mis at Village Theater. Which was so freaking incredible. When I saw the posters around town, I thought it was actually like a touring production. So I was like, well, I really want to see it. It's here. How coincidental that it's in town when I just moved here. And then I realized it was actually this local group, this
right.
local company that does it. And I remember sitting in the Everett Theater watching the show and thinking like, oh, this company's amazing. I really, really want to work with them someday. But like, I'm brand new. How am I ever going to get this opportunity? And like a few months later, they announced their season. And Around the World in 80 Days was there. And I was like, the Indian princess. And growing up, the book had a lot of impact on me, too. But what had even more of an impact was a TV miniseries in 1989 with Pierce Brosnan as Phileas Fogg, Eric Idle as Passepartout, and Peter Ustinov as Detective Fix. And then there was this she was Asian-American actress named Julia Nixon who played the Indian Princess Aouda. And I remember looking at her and being like, she's so beautiful. She's so graceful. I just want to be her. Like, I just want to be her. So I was really, really lucky that the casting director, who I'm sure many of your listeners know is Troy Wegman at the time, called me in for In the Heights. And I was like, oh man, I haven't done a musical in so long, but I'm going to go out there and I'm going to do my best. And I'm just happy to get the opportunity. I went and, I met so many fabulous people at that callback. And I didn't get it, which was totally fine because I was not right for that role. And I emailed Troy and I said, you know, I know you guys are doing 80 Days Later on this season. I would love to be considered for the Indian Princess. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge.
I'm getting shivers.
And he was like, oh, absolutely, absolutely. And they came down to casting. He called me in for a callback and I got the gig. And it was just incredible because for me, it was kind of so many points of my life just coming together at one moment. It was right. Like my childhood and this woman that I saw and loved and watched a million times in that movie, I get to finally be that character, you know? And then also because I just love the fact that I get to play this Victorian Indian woman and wear this gorgeous gown.
Your
and
costume.
Oh, my costume was...
Wow.
I mean, whoever saw that, you know what that costume... That costume meant so much to me. I love that costume so much. But yeah, I mean, who doesn't want to be able to wear a pretty costume like that and a beautiful wig and things like that? So it was just a dream come true to be able to do that. And then with those four guys who were absolutely so much fun and so funny.
It was such a tight cast and the way the set... Just one of those shows that's really unique and all the elements align perfectly.
Yeah. I think there was some, like, there was mixed feelings about the show itself.
Oh,
but
really?
I think that there was, like, some people who really liked it and then some people who really didn't like it, which is fine. I mean, that's theater. Not everyone's going to like everything, which is fine. But what was really fun for us as a cast was that we all had so much fun doing that every night. It was a crazy, crazy experience.
Those are going to be people who, it's like a little family.
Yes.
Each show is, but those shows when it's ensemble and everyone's on stage for almost every scene. And
exactly.
Switching hats and,
oh, yeah.
And all of that.
And it was great because it was kind of like my first big gig in Seattle too. I mean, I was here in 2006 with a tour for Bombay Dreams, but this was my first, like, I now live here and I get to be a part of the show with other people that have lived here and are part of the business here. And then being in the Everett Theater exactly a year after I had seen Les Mis there was just like, woo, this is so incredible. Like, it was an amazing feeling to feel that way and to feel like I have found a way to, like, into the community of actors here and artists here, which felt really nice. It was like kind of this warm welcome.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Thank
amazing.
You.
Let's talk. You just launched an original web series.
I did.
That you are writing and producing and starring in and directing?
I directed the pilot.
Okay.
But hopefully, if we get the funding for the rest of the season, we're going to be bringing on different directors for each episode. But yes,
fantastic.
I did. Yeah, I did write it. And it's called Crave. And it's about, basically the story kind of revolves around these three different people. And my character is an actress who's trying to make her mark in show business, and she happens to be trans. And on any given day, that's her biggest asset or her biggest liability.
So the tagline.
Yes.
Gets you hooked.
Yes, so it gets you hooked. And we launched the pilot a little over a week ago on June 6th, and the response has been really great. So we just want people to watch, and if they've got some money, they can throw some money via the Kickstarter campaign.
Because you're crowdfunding.
Yes, we are
the
crowdfunding.
The rest of the season.
Yes, so we paid for and produced the pilot with our own money and resources and the very big help of many, many artists in this city, which I'm so thankful for. But yes, we are crowdfunding the rest of the season. So,
where did this project come from for you? Because I'm sort of reading through the Kickstarter and some of the other... I just think your presence online is so spot on because it's such a hard thing as a performer. You have to be assertive, but you don't want to be aggressive. You want people to know about stuff, but you don't want to annoy them and you want to have your own original voice. And I just feel that you hit that balance just right.
Well, thank you, because I don't. I appreciate you saying that because I think I oftentimes, and I think maybe every actor goes through this. I mean, there are times where you think, oh my God, have I really crossed the line here? Like, oh my God, I've totally pissed these people off. Nobody was going to ever want to hire me again. And especially in a town like Seattle where everybody knows everybody and
right.
The town is really small. If you make an enemy, you might as well move to another town. So, I mean, definitely, I generally consider myself a nice person. So I don't make many enemies. And if
right.
someone usually hates me, I mean, I don't know why. Because I don't know what I did to you to make you hate me. But the story came out of... Like, my experiences as a trans actress and going on a lot of different auditions for a lot of projects that you've seen. And not necessarily getting hired, which is fine. I mean, you're not, as an actor, you're not going to get every single
role.
You're
used to rejection.
You're used to rejection. Yeah. But then seeing how fast and the exponential growth that trans visibility is taking over right now in popular culture and social issues and in the media, and thinking, like, this story is so relevant right now.
Right.
Right now, this story is, like, the best time to get it out there. And almost that I feel like it's a little ahead of its time, because it's the majority of trans stories that we are seeing deal with transitioning.
Right.
Deal with the spectacle of transitioning, deal with making the transition the main focus of that character, when trans people are so much more than that. Not saying that, and to minimize the process of the transition, but there are so many more aspects to a trans person than just the transition. So what my show, I'm hoping to do with it, is to show that there's a whole life after transition, and we meet my character years after her transition, when she's settled down and she's trying to find work as an actress, and, you know, she's this side job as a nanny, but
that
to this
opening
bratty
scene,
kid.
if you haven't seen the pilot's about 16 minutes long.
Yes.
It's on YouTube, but it's what the website is.
The website is craveoriginalseries.com.
And it's right up there. You can press play right away.
Right away. Yep.
That opening scene, I'm just like, every actor can relate to that. And
oh,
it's hilarious.
And so I conceived this show 3 years ago, but in its current inception was kind of developed in the fall of last year.
Okay.
And actually that scene that is now in the pilot, actually I wrote like just a week before we actually shot. There was a filler scene in there, and I knew that I wanted the opening scene to be of an audition, and I wanted it to probably take place at TPS, because that is such a known
That's
thing.
Go.
That's where you go. That's such a known experience for all the actors in town.
And the casting, Shane.
Shane. So Shane was a last minute casting choice, and we are so grateful that he could do that, because it was, couldn't have been more perfect to have Shane do that, to be that casting director, and to be this, like, extremely misogynistic for this Swifty cleaner, toilet bowl cleaner. That's the kind of impact I wanted, and I wanted to show, like, okay, that sometimes actors have to go do ridiculous things in order to make a living. And this
I'm nodding violently, which does not transfer well to an audio medium, but yes.
Yes. And yeah, so I mean, that's how it kind of all started, and then the rest of the story is just kind of flowed through experiences and people that I know and putting it all together.
What's your writing process like? Do you set a schedule? Do you just sort of, the scene comes to you, you see it, you just sort of sit down at the computer just then? Or
That's my problem. I can sometimes feel a workaholic, and the way I wrote season one was exactly that. I stayed up all night because I thought about something, and I'd be like, I've got to write this down right now. So I'd open Celtics on my computer, and I'd just pop it all in, and then be like, well, what happened if this happened? And then I'd write the next episode, and I'd be like, and so I kind of wrote the first draft of season one in one night, and I stayed up till 5 a.m., and wow. I was very grateful to one of my friends, Sandra, who was up that late, and I was like, all right, I'm just done with this episode, will you read it? And then she'd read it and send me notes back, and then I'd start the next one. And it was just kind of this process of doing that. And then after I did that, I gathered some friends, and we went and read, and I got some notes and did some more changes and then revised the script. But the original, like, the first draft, I just, like, knocked it out in one night. Because I had this idea and I just had to put it down on paper. Otherwise, I was going to forget everything because I'm such a forgetful person.
Did you map out the entire arc of the first season that night? Or
I had an idea of where I wanted these characters' lives to go. I didn't necessarily know exactly how they were going to get there or what obstacles would be in their way, but I knew that I wanted my character to go from point A to point B, and I knew I wanted, you know, the character of Karen to go from point A to point B, and the character of Bobby to go from point A to B, and that was kind of like a basis, and it's changed since then, but it was definitely helpful to know exactly the starting and end point. It was just the filling in that kind of took the longest part for me.
Did you have actors in mind writing these roles, or did you write for the characters and then cast the roles?
So there was only, I guess there was really only one actress I had in mind for the role of Karen. Because one of my very, very, very best friends, Sonia, who lives in LA, she's kind of not that the character is based off of her, but I saw her playing that role. So it was very easy to write that character for me because I just imagined what if both of us were in these situations and these are the conversations that we would have.
You knew her voice.
Yeah. And then Jeremy Behrens, who plays Bobby, was actually at the very, very first reading for this here in Seattle. And that was last fall when it's kind of in its new inception. And he was referred to me by a friend that I was working with on a Fringe Festival show. And she read the script and she was like, oh, I know the perfect guy who's perfect for Bobby. You should meet him. And I was like, okay. So I contacted Jeremy and I was like, hey, you want to do this reading? And he was like, yeah, I'd love to. And he was amazing in the reading. I was like, there's no need for me to go look for anybody else. So yeah, that Jeremy Behrens, better watch out. He's so good in the pilot. I love watching his scenes. So
did you hold auditions for the other roles?
We did. Yeah, we did.
Angela DeMarco. I'm like fangirling out. I just am recently knowing of her work and seeing her in the pilot and then seeing her in Lisa Halperin's reading at Seattle Rep last week. I'm like,
she is a powerhouse.
Damn.
She is a powerhouse. And I feel like, I mean, obviously you don't know much about Karen because there's one scene of her, just her stuff, before you see the three friends at the end. But I just like, I really, really want us to get the funding for the rest of the season because there's so much meaty stuff that I'm giving Angela to do because I know she is such a powerhouse of a woman and an actress. And she's so inspirational to be around on set because she's very knowledgeable about the industry as well. So it's funny because we had our launch party on Saturday at one of the castmates' house. And when she showed up, it was like, I literally had this like out of body experience where I was just like, I feel complete now. Like, Angela DeMarco is here. I feel whole. Like, that was the feeling that I got. And I was totally fangirl over her all the time, even though I've gotten the chance to work with her.
Well, okay. So we want people to go watch the pilot.
Yes.
And then back the Kickstarter because we need to see more of this series.
And, like, if everybody who's listening to this donates even $5, I mean, that's a latte at Starbucks, you know? I mean, just please skip a latte one day and give us $5. And if everybody gave us $5, we could make it. We could totally make this.
And your perks are really great. Like, we even have, at the $5 level, you get, like, a postcard.
You get a postcard signed by us. Yeah. And then at the higher levels, you get some really, really cool stuff. We get, one of my favorites is we'll have a disposable camera on set, and we'll go around taking behind-the-scenes photos, and each person who buys that perk will have their own sets of behind-the-scenes photos.
Completely
unique, which is one of my favorite. And then one of the really higher ones is you get to have dinner with me, Jeremy, and Angela, which I think is super fun, because we're all really cool and funny, and especially together.
I have to win the lottery so I can get that perk. Yeah. Fingers crossed. So something which is like the coolest example of content marketing I think I've almost ever seen in my life is the Vanity Fair cover. There was that iconic image of Caitlyn Jenner, and then people started submitting their own hashtag My Vanity Fair cover.
Hashtag My Vanity Fair cover. Yes.
And so you created one as your character.
Yes.
Which was featured prominently on Elle's website.
Yes, which was so crazy. So Jen Delary and Crystal Fraser are the two women that created this extremely viral campaign that was hashtag My Vanity Fair cover in the days after Caitlyn Jenner came out and that whole Vanity Fair cover happened. And it came from, I think it was Jen or Crystal, one of them basically saying, like, well, where's my Vanity Fair cover? And not being like selfish about it, but saying, you know, there are so many trans people in this country who don't get Vanity Fair covers, who don't get Anne Leibovitz to photograph them, who don't even have safe access to healthcare. So I am very proud of Caitlyn Jenner for coming out. I just also have a lot of thoughts about the other side of the coin, which is missed when something like that happens. But bringing me back to the My Vanity Fair cover hashtag, that came out to basically bring visibility to the hundreds of thousands of trans people in this country to be like, look, I am beautiful as well, and I am deserving of this visibility, and I'm human, and you should recognize that we exist. And it was really great. And selfishly, I was like, this is going to be amazing. And it was like literally like 2 or 3 days after I saw the hashtag. So kind of at the very beginning of the whole, when it became viral, I was like, let me just make one for Maggie and I'll just tweet it and see what happens. And the next morning, like, my cousin wrote me and she was like, hey, did you know you're on this blog called Celeb Bitchy? And I was like, what? So I looked, and then another friend of mine was like, hey girl, you're on Elle. And I was like, this is crazy. So, I mean, I hope it worked and it led people to the Crave series.
Right.
But, I mean, it was a selfish move. But, I mean, it was definitely, I think, a good marketing ploy.
It must be thrilling to open Facebook and it's like, there you are. And you had nothing. You didn't post it.
I did not post it at all. I was right there. Someone found it, came across it. And it was like on Elle. It was on Daily Post. It was on, a bunch of other websites. And I was like, how is this possible? Like, I'm very thankful for the visibility, for sure. And I'm glad that that's happening for a lot of people.
Absolutely. Can we dig into your artist origin story?
Absolutely. Let's dig deep.
We're a bunch of theater geeks over here. We're making gestures with our hands. Again, something that you can't see. But was there a moment growing up when you were in front of people, you were performing, and you were like, this, that inner bell, you know, like, this is my gig, this is what I need to do?
Yes. So, I always loved performing, and it was so weird, because I loved being on stage, but I never liked being in the spotlight. I was always so nervous. There was, like, videos of me in like high school at a vocal recital singing with my back to the audience, because I was so nervous.
Oh,
I just... Immense stage fright. And then I went to college for musical theater, and my first year...
NYU.
Yeah, I went to NYU. It was
I'm in awe.
Oh, please. I had never studied acting. I had just studied voice throughout my entire life. So I went to college in a musical theater program and had a vocal audition. I did a monologue, but I'm sure that they didn't accept me on my monologue because it was terrible.
Do you remember what you sang?
I sang I Have Dreamed from The King and I. Yes.
Oh.
Yes. Of course, it was a very different person back then.
Right.
And a very different type of singer. So, so I got into this program and I was super excited. And my first year, I really felt like I struggled during acting, during my acting classes. And during my vocal tech classes, I really soared because I had so much training leading up
to... That was your wheelhouse.
That was my wheelhouse. But then when it came to vocal performance, I was kind of like, I had like my teacher... having the entire class waving their hands if my eyes started going dead or something, because I just didn't know how to connect those two. And my sophomore year of college, I had this incredible teacher named Alex Corey. And she was on Broadway too. And I was doing Giants in the Sky for vocal performance class, and I was just not connecting. I mean, it was just really frustrating for me at that point because I was in my second year. And anyway, she came in and she like whispered something into my ear, and it was like this moment where everything just kind of clicked. And I learned in that moment how to be truthful to myself and to how to push that out and what I'm doing.
Right.
And it was kind of that moment that I had where I was like, this is what I need to be doing for the rest of my life. Because now I've like tapped into exactly what I need to be doing, how to do it. And I love it and I can't get enough. So I had always really loved being in the theater, but it wasn't until that moment that I was like, I need to be a storyteller and I need to be able to tell my stories in this way.
Wow. That's absolutely incredible.
Oh.
It's like your face absolutely lit up.
Oh yeah. I mean, it was a magical moment, and I still think about it to this day. Like, and when people ask me, they're like, what was that moment for you? And that memory lives in my head so clearly.
What
and I hope if Alex is listening, she knows that. I mean, I've told her many times, but I'm sure she knows it.
What were some of, were there any other moments that stood out to you during your time there? Were there roles where you're like, that was really cool, or I felt that was a defining moment, or?
I wish I could go back and do my training again.
Yeah.
Because I presented very femininely.
Sure.
I was wearing makeup, I had long hair, and sometimes I'd wear girl clothes, but I was using the male pronouns. And I think that my teachers had no idea what to make of me. So I would get these scenes where I would be playing a man and I would be very uncomfortable, and I'd do them to the best of my ability.
Right.
But at the end of the day, I still wasn't being true to me. And so I would love to go back to my training and do it all over again just to see what happens.
gender in theater is so performative anyway, to have that extra layer added onto it. I mean, I've I got to play Pirelli in Sweeney Todd. It was more of a, I was just the wrong age, and the director was like, would you be open to doing this role in drag? It was one of the coolest things I ever got to do, because there's this freedom of, like, getting away from the expectations of how you're supposed to behave, and theater gives you that freedom anyway, and so gender in theater, my senior project in college was, I directed Christopher Durang's Beyond Therapy, and, like, the title was Beyond Therapy, Beyond Social Constructions of Gender and Sexuality, and I made, like, all of my actors read all of this gender performance theory, and my friend Dylan, who I know, Dylan, I know you're listening to this in Minneapolis, he told me so while he bikes, but that was the first trans person I had met, and they were my stage manager, and they really kept everything on point. You know, they were sort of the truth teller and bringing it all back to that.
Yeah.
You were in the Broadway National Tour of a show. Was that shortly after your time at NYU? Or?
Yes. So that was literally, so actually.
Random transition. I jump all over.
That's okay. And it actually deals with gender, ironically enough. The backstory of Bombay Dreams is I have a very, very, very close friend who lives in London, family friend. He's, like, practically my brother. And he was like, oh, this is back in 2001. And he was like, oh, there's this this new show that they're thinking about making based on Bollywood movies. It's called Bombay Dreams, and it's the composer's this Indian guy. And he's like, you should really, like, email the casting director and see if you can get an audition, even though you're in New York and I'm in London. And I was like, hey, I'll do it anyway. Didn't think anything would happen. 2 months later, they called me and they were like, hey, we want to bring you in. This is a brand new show we're creating, so we're not really sure where this is even going, but we want to bring you in for this one role, who is for the role of a hijra, which is basically in India the equivalent of a trans person. Although, that's a whole other discussion. So I was like, okay, great. They called me in. I had a great audition. They called me later that night. They said, come in tomorrow and sing some more stuff. I was like, great, I'll do that. So I went in and sang some more stuff. And a week later then, they called me and they're like, we're flying you to London. I was like, wonderful. They flew me into London. I workshopped with Andrew Lloyd Webber and the rest of the... Yeah,
what?
It was crazy. Workshopped with him and workshopped with the rest of the creative team. Chris Nightingale and Farah Khan, who was the choreographer at the time. And Lisa Stevens, who was the choreographer on the national tour, was the assistant choreographer on that show, or the dance captain. And I was there for literally 36 hours. I workshopped 2 days, pretty much, at the studio. It was more like a day and three quarters. And they, right after the workshop, they put me in a car and sent me back to the airport, and I got on a plane and flew back to New York. And I workshopped this role called Sweetie, who was this trans person. And I didn't end up getting it. And I was like, okay, bummer. I was still in college. I was like, it's fine. I was still early in my career.
I got to meet Andrew Lloyd Webber.
I got to meet and work with Andrew Lloyd Webber. I mean, that's enough of a checkbox off of my list. Then 3 years later, they're transferring it to Broadway. And they call me. And they're like, hey, obviously, we want to see you for this. And I was like, great. And they ended up giving it to somebody else. And so, obviously, I mean, this kind of also ties into Crave. I mean, this has happened to me so much in my life that this is where Crave's story...
You get so close.
You get so close, right. So anyway, they... After they cast Broadway, I was kind of, like, really pissed off at them. And I was like, I don't want to talk to the people. If they ever call me again, I'm never going to audition. Then, like, 6 months later, they called me in. And they're like, we're going to do a little mini tour of just, like, some songs for these benefit concerts. Would you like to do it? And I was like, great. So, like, okay, come in and work with the choreographer for an hour. And I did. And they're like, oh, we don't need you. I was like, what?
What?
So it was 2005, at the end of 2005. And I was like, I invited my friend over on this ploy of we're going to watch movies and TV. This is becoming a really long story. I'm so sorry.
I love that.
Okay. So she comes over for pizza and beer. And I tell her that she's coming over to watch a movie, but I tell her that actually when she shows up that we're rearranging my furniture. So I rearrange my furniture and I'm taking these multiple versions of the Bombay Dream script that I have from all these workshops. And I'm like, I never will need these again. I don't care. And I throw them in the trash and we get drunk and we go to bed. The next morning, no joke, at 10 a.m., the phone rings. It's the casting director and they're like, we want to see you for the Broadway National Tour. And I was like, do you want to see me or do you want to just hire me? Because at this point, I don't know
Good
what else
you
could show me, right? I mean, I didn't say it in that many words. Right. I was very grateful that they called me, and I went in, and I basically showed them, this is what I've been working on with all of you creators for the past 4 years. And basically in the audition, the producer was like, so what's your schedule? What are your conflicts like? And I was like, well, I'm actually going to India for 2 weeks, but after that I'm free. And the day after I came back from India, my rehearsal started. And I was on tour for the Bombay Dreams National Tour for 10 months, which ended here in Seattle at the Fifth Avenue Theater in October of 2006. And my character was a transgender character. And this was two or three years before I even thought about transitioning. So it was just it was like foreshadowing of some sort.
I strongly believe, this is my like theater karma philosophy, that as hard as it is to be an actor and as much rejection as we go through, we very specifically get the roles that we need in our life at the times that we need them. Yes. Hard as that is to be, like when you've nailed the audition.
Oh, yes.
And even when you're in a callback and you see what the person who got it did. And
oh,
you're
yes. Like, how did I? Yes. Yes. And what's even worse is when you go into these auditions, and this has happened to me many times too, is, you know, no offense to the people that decide one morning that they want to go to an audition because their friend told them to. So they take a day off from work and they go to an audition and they're like, hey, acting's easy. And they end up getting the job. That, I mean, no offense to them, but, you know, those kind of people piss me off because I'm like, do you realize there are people who have worked and slaved blood, sweat, and tears in this business for so many years who have those opportunities who don't get them? And I mean, it's not a fair business. It's theater. It's show business. It's not fair. I'm just being bitter and cranky.
I think you're being realistic.
I am being realistic.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of your successes. Let's,
sure.
Yes.
Let's move on from my failures.
You were on an NBC sitcom called Outsourced.
Yes.
Let's talk about that audition you got, obviously.
Yes.
Can you talk about that process?
Sure. So after I transitioned, I didn't think I could act anymore. I mean, I didn't necessarily look the way I look now.
Right.
But I was like, nobody's going to ever hire me. I was already struggling to make a living as a cis male South Asian actor.
Right.
What would ever make me think that as a trans South Asian actress, I would be making an even better living? Ironically enough, I have been working more as a woman than I ever did as a man, which is so crazy. But NBC came after me taking a 3-year hiatus, going back to grad school to be a social worker. And one of my castmates from Bombay Dreams was like, hey, the producers on Outsourced, who he was on the show, he was like, are looking for this character to play this transgender character on the show. They're going to be in 2 episodes and it's a guest spot. Would you want to? I recommended you and they really want to see your tape. And I was like, awesome. Submitted like this really corny tape. And within like 3 days, the network approved it, the casting director approved it, and they were like, all right, great, you're going to be shooting these 3 days.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
you didn't even have another audition. It was just the tape.
Just the tape. Just the tape.
Who did you get to? Did you get to work with Dietrich Bader?
Yes.
I love
Dietrich Bader.
I've Googled you heavily.
So Dietrich and I don't know if you've seen the episodes.
I haven't, no.
Okay, that's totally okay. The season finale, I'm like in the first couple minutes of, and Dietrich Bader and I wake up in bed together after a hard night of partying, which is so fun. And he is the sweetest actor I've ever met in Hollywood. He really is like such a nice guy. But yes, it was super fun. And I got to also see a lot of my colleagues from Bombay Dreams, because believe it or not, there's a very small pool of South Asian actors, you know, so we all kind of sometimes meet multiple times in different places, different times in different jobs.
Did that gig open up more opportunities for
it
you?
Did. So I definitely got seen for a lot of other projects. It was really nice to kind of gain, like, that was kind of like my foot in the door. And
right.
All of a sudden, it was like, all right, you're going to go for this audition, you're going to go for this audition, you're going to go for this audition. So it was really nice to kind of do that. But I was also living in San Francisco at the time, so getting to LA was a lot easier. It happens less frequently now that I'm in Seattle, but I don't feel like I have a lack of auditioning here, because my agent here in Seattle is fabulous about sending me out. And like I said, I've been working more as a woman than I ever did as a man.
I saw that you did a series of Microsoft yes. commercials, which were kind of... You were, like, the boss, keeping everyone in line.
That was so fun.
How Can you talk about the differences and what you like or dislike about theater work versus film versus industrial kind
yeah.
of things?
I kind of look at industrial and film and TV work all as one and sure. theater as another. Just because I approach all of that work kind of the same as an actor. I mean, when you're on set and the client wants something different, it's a different story than as the way you prepare as an actor to go into those jobs. You get a script, it's a character, even if you're just talking about stuff like programming and sharing data, you know, it's still your script that you gotta be attached to in some way. But I love the theater because I love live moments and I love the energy of people. Like, I hate doing monologue work because I love reacting with other people.
That moment.
And, right, yeah. and creating that energy and creating that conversation. That's like another reason why I wanted Crave to be an ensemble piece and not just my story, because I think there's so many different stories that need to be told. I lost my train of thought. And what was your question again?
comparing
film and TV.
Maybe how do you build a character differently for those two different...
I feel like in theater, you usually have a little more information.
Right.
At least for me. It's always easier for me, and maybe it's because I've been doing it for so long, it's easier for me to read a play than it is a screenplay or a pilot episode or, you know, a TV episode, something like that. And I feel like it's harder to get more out of that than it is in a play, where you can just look and highlight and make notes and be like, oh, well, this is what this person says about that person. And so in terms of approaching it, I think for me it's easier to approach theater work than it is kind of other work. Also because I'm more new to the film and TV side than I am
right.
theater.
Just sort of going back to your training, are there philosophies of acting that you really, that really resonate with you? Or do you sort of like, it's what I, it's, is it more...
So I was trained Stanislavski based.
Oh, okay.
So that,
ugh.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, I resonate a lot with that kind of training.
Sure.
I've tried some Meisner.
Sorry.
No, I. yeah, I mean, it
you're
wasn't
wearing,
for me.
You're wearing a blue shirt. I'm wearing a blue shirt.
Right. You're wearing a blue shirt.
I can't get anything
I
out
can't,
of that.
No. I could not do my.
No disrespect to people who subscribe to Meisner work.
Right.
It's not for everybody.
Right. It's not for everybody. But yeah, and I think what I took from Stanislavski's work is how true you have to be to yourself as a person in order to be a successful actor and to make successful characters. Somebody in my training at one point said, your character isn't necessarily another person, it's who you are in those situations, which is kind of good and kind of bad. I mean, obviously if you're playing a serial killer, I mean... But I mean, I think it's a good way to approach text and it's a good way to approach a character. And it's like, well, if that was me, how would I approach this? And how would I say this line? And what would I be feeling in this moment? Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I like to ask actors, especially theater actors, what is on your bucket list? What are those roles where you're like... This is something that's going to happen. I got to play it.
Oh, so many.
Tell you all of them.
I want to play Gigi in Miss Saigon. I might be a little old now.
No.
But maybe it'll be fun if she's old. I mean, you know, the really pathetic Gigi. She's that old and still a stripper. I want to play Lady Tiang.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it comes down to, like, ethnic casting, especially now in terms of relevant discussions
right.
we're having in the arts. It's what is ethnically appropriate to cast. If we were in a world where that wasn't a question, these are roles that obviously I would love to play. If someone ever did a revival of Bombay Dreams, I would love to play Sweetie again. I think I would be able to approach that role in a very different mindset
right.
than I did before. What else is on my bucket list? I don't know. I have to think more about that. I need to make one.
Do you ever, like, I just, like, I feel like you would kill it doing, like, Chekhov or Ibsen.
Ooh,
like,
I really want to play Hedda Gabler. That's...
Yes. I saw the Ibsen within
yes.
you.
So, funny story, speaking of roles that are almost there. when I was living in San Francisco, a company was doing Hedda Gabler, and somebody called me in for Hedda, and I was like, oh my God, people are seeing beyond what's written in the text, which is wonderful. And I went, and I made sure I rocked my audition, and I didn't get it. It was two girls left. It was me and a very tall Norwegian-looking blonde girl.
Boo.
I knew kind of that I wasn't going to get it, but when the call came, I was heartbroken. But a couple of weeks later, it was Christmas, and the director had sent me a card in the mail saying happy holidays and that she really loved my audition and that she's sorry she couldn't use me. Mm. She wanted to, but she was outnumbered. Which was nice as her as a director to really kind of relay that message, which is also, as an actor, you're kind of like, well, why did you even bother telling me that? But it woke me up to be like, I want to create work where it shouldn't matter, where you're going to hire the best actor to do the job regardless of their skin color, their gender identity, whatever, their sexual orientation.
Right.
Hire actors for actors for the jobs that they do. And one day I will play Hedda Gabler because I was this close to playing it and I really want to, and she's such a great role and that's such a wonderful play.
Well, I'll be the first in line to buy that ticket.
Hey, great. let's make it happen.
Maybe I'll be the girl whose hair you pull. Maybe,
there we go.
I cannot remember her name.
Thea? Thea?
Yes, so yes.
I don't know how to pronounce it. Thea?
Thea.
So yeah, that's on my bucket list. These might be totally unrealistic goals, but hey, we're dreaming here,
know.
Right?
This is the thing: you never know. You never know who's listening to this. Who's like,
give me a job. I need a job. Who's ever listening? Please give me a job. Yeah, you never know who's listening.
Yeah, they could have that on their docket for next season, and it's not even announced.
There
yet,
you go.
So.
There you go.
I also like to ask my guests what advice they have for maybe other actors, or if someone has an idea for a web series if they have a story they want to tell, what advice would you give to writer actors?
So I don't know if I'm in the best place to give writing advice, because this is really the first semi-successful thing that I've written that has actually gotten up off the ground. But to any artist, I would just say, do you. I mean, I feel like that's so hard and so easy at the same time, especially in this industry. Like, if you aren't you, sometimes people don't want to use the real you, or they want you to be somebody else. Or, the kind of actor that I am, and the kind of, because now that I'm getting into producing and directing, like, the kind of artist that I am as a whole is I respond very well to people who are the authentic selves, right. You know? Who are really true to who they are and to the kind of work that they want to put out. And it's kind of like there's no ulterior motives. It's art for art's sake. And if it's great that it turns out to be this super successful money-making thing, wonderful. But I mean, who doesn't want to have like $1 million contract and, you know, or make $10,000 an episode? That's
right.
But there's also got to be like a really authentic reason to want to put that out there. And as an artist, I respond well to that. And I think that more people should be like that, because I think that makes us better artists as well as better human beings. If that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So not only, I think that the older I get, I'm turning 30 this year, and I'm actually excited about it, because when I was a little kid, I always like thought like, I'm really like 30. Like, I know I'm 7 now, but I feel like I should be a grown up.
Oh yeah. Your 30s are when your life takes off. We'll totally attest to that.
Exciting.
Yes.
But that idea of defining success for yourself instead of what society, I mean, whatever your chosen field is as an artist.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You have to define your own success, because if you don't define your own success, you shouldn't just hold your standard to yourself to the standards put on by others. But I mean, it could be a very mentally depressing thing if you don't acknowledge the steps that you have made as an artist, whether they're big or small. But to say like, hey, I'm going to be a background in this commercial that they're shooting. I mean, it's like, don't diminish all the work that you're getting and the steps that you're making as an artist, whatever that may be. Even at the point where you are making $10,000 as an episode.
Right.
You know, like, take that moment to acknowledge where you are in your life as an artist and what you're doing with the work that you're doing.
And celebrating your successes. Yeah, absolutely. I was listening. Yeah, at whatever level that is. I was listening to Marc Maron was interviewing Henry Winkler, the Fonz, and he has this amazing series of children's books for children with learning disabilities, because he has pretty severe dyslexia that went undiagnosed until he was 30, but when he goes into classrooms, the first question he always asks all the kids is, does anyone know what they're really great at? And those kids, their hands shoot up. And I think the older we get, the more we think it's ego-driven to answer that question.
Yes.
And it's not.
It's
not. You have to celebrate the stuff. Know what you're really good at and celebrate that.
Absolutely. And I think there's a very fine line between having that confidence and then being egotistical. And I think as artists, we have to be really careful not to cross that line, which happens way too often. And we all do it, especially if we get a big job or something and we're like, I'm tough shit now. Nobody can touch me, you know, something like that. But I think it's always better to kind of stay on the other side of that line and know, be proud of your successes, but to stay humble and remember that what it took to get there, you know, and that there are other people who are still working just as hard to get there.
Right. Not to paraphrase this interview, the Henry Winkler interview too much, although it was fantastic and I would recommend it, but he says, like, getting through his career, and he's had this amazing career.
Oh, like, yeah.
40, 50 years of working pretty much nonstop. And he's like, my two words are tenacity and gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm like, okay, the Fonzie, I will take that advice.
That is very true. I like that. Tenacity and gratitude. If you don't have those, I mean, yeah.
So other than, as we sort of wind down our time together,
sure.
Other than Crave, what other projects are coming up that you can talk about? Because I know some stuff is in development.
Yeah, really. Yeah. I am super excited to be being a part of the Seattle Play Series that's happening in Capitol Hill in early July with Courtney Kessler.
And I haven't heard of this.
Okay, yeah. They do these play series, and they just had one in Green Lake a couple of weeks ago, if not last weekend. And they're gearing up to do another set of them. And they're new works, they're short works. I'm directing to, and I'm going to be into. And Courtney Kessler is kind of the one who's kind of handling all of it and putting it together. So people should definitely check that out. There's event pages on Facebook, and I'm sure there's a website.
Great, yeah. We'll put that in the episode description. And when are those happening specifically?
So those plays are happening the 11th and 12th of July.
Okay.
It's a Monday and Tuesday. I believe those dates are correct. And I'm super excited to be a part of that because, yeah, just I love getting involved with new stuff. And like I said, I'm only been here a year and a half, so I'm still learning.
Making,
yeah,
you're making your mark.
I'm making my mark. Yeah.
And is that's the main? Those are the two main things where we can see your work out in the world.
Out in the world, yes.
Well, thank you. This has been so great.
Thank
to sit down
you.
And talk with you.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm so happy you asked me to come. I'm super psyched. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, go watch Crave the series right now after downloading this episode. And thank you again so much.
Thanks, Katie.